Well, good evening and welcome, my friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm Karen Tate, and tonight's musical offering opening the show was Song of the Siren by Morgan Baum at sacredhands.org. Well, wow, what a week. The weather here in Los Angeles has been beautiful, and you, my listeners and friends, have been beautiful and so supportive, too. Thanks so much to those of you who have taken time out of your busy day to write me. Congratulations about receiving my doctorate of ministry from Ocean Seminary College. Your gas in my tank and the needles on full, all because of you. Also, I hope you saw the awesome video put together by Alfred Surinyan of our last trip to Turkey. He's actually conducting that music, that hauntingly beautiful variation of Ancient Mother playing in the background. As you look at the video clips and images of the sites and goddesses that we saw in Turkey on our last trip. And we're going again this November, a group of men and women. So if you haven't seen the video, or you might not even know what I'm talking about, or maybe you do, or if you haven't heard of the trip, please email me at karentate108@ca.rr.com. I can send you a link, and I think very soon it will be on my website if it's not up there already. Sacred shopping, as we call it, ritual, whirling dervishes, Turkish baths, hot mineral springs, very near the site of Aphrodisias, sacred to Aphrodite, wonderful museums, archaeological sites, definitely a feast for the senses, the body, and the soul. Truly, truly. Turkey is a diamond in the rough and a melting pot of goddess and all her diversity. And closer to home, maybe even in a town near you, if you're in Southern California particularly, I know about these, check it out. This Saturday in Orange County and next Saturday in Los Angeles, there are going to be Stop the War rallies. So please make the time to go. Put your angst into action. It's 12 noon at Hollywood and Vine in Los Angeles, not this Saturday but next. The purpose is to end the occupations in Afghanistan and Iraq, to fund jobs, health care, and education, not the military-industrial complex, to stop budget cuts, tuition hikes, and attacks on work and families. So from Egypt to Wisconsin to Los Angeles, the people have the power. The GOP has awakened a sleeping dragon, and we're breathing fire. These rallies are happening all over the country. Have you heard about the rallies in and outside banks all around the country? Well, you might not have, because the mainstream media is not doing much coverage of all of this. If you're not in the Los Angeles area, look into getting tapped into groups like Answer Coalition, the ACLU, Code Pink, Now, MoveOn.org. All these people are uniting together to fight back. Remember, turn your angst into action. Get out there and be counted. And it's fun. It's empowering. It gives you hope. You know you're not alone. You know, my husband and I had the best time making our signs for the rally a few weeks ago in support of workers in Wisconsin. My husband's favorite sign was, "Don't teabag our unions." It actually made some national photographs. But make it a family event. Use it to teach your kids citizenship and about participatory democracy. Hey, if we want the world to change, if we don't want to be the United States of Coke, we can't wait for somebody else to do it. And as I promised, in honor of Keith Olbermann of Countdown fame on MSNBC, who we know will be back in June as the news director on Al Gore's Current TV, I'll ask the question I know he would have been asking every night. Mr. Boehner, you with the big gavel, where are the jobs? We thought you were so concerned, or so you said, but all you seem to be working on are culture war issues and taking from the poor and protecting the rich, redefining rape, trying to take the rights of women to their bodies away from them, taking away rights of workers. What's next? Have you figured out a way to privatize breathing yet? Hyperbole? Maybe. But we're not buying what you're selling, Mr. Boehner and company. Such transparent puppets. Okay, that will have to do for my What's the Buzz rant. Some new developments. Blog Talk is no longer free, so our show is looking for a sponsor. You may have heard that before. If not, just get in touch with me. They're not charging us a lot of money yet, but I'm hoping if you like Voices of the Sacred Feminine, you will help support the show. What you tend to, what you nurture and nourish, well, it thrives, and what you neglect, it withers. So thanks to those of you who have already sent in donations, and I would appreciate your support. There are PayPal buttons on my website at KarenTate.com. You can make donations large or small. Lots of little ones all add up. Also, if you're looking at my show page on your computer, remember the three F's. I would love it if you would look there on the show page and mark Voices of the Sacred Feminine a favorite. Also, mark us as your friend. But maybe most important, click the follow button so that you never miss notice of my new guests each week. That way, you're a part of our growing family of listeners across the globe. And if you're listening tonight live, you can call in later and talk to myself or my guest, ask questions. The number to call in is 718-766-4662. I know most of you listen from the archives, but if you'd like to call in, I will get to you when we have a natural lapse in the conversation, and I'll identify you by your area code and invite you to ask your question. So, without further delay, let me get to our guest tonight, Bob Walter. Let me tell you a little bit about Bob before we start our chat. Officially, Robert Walker. He's earned his BSS from Northwestern University. Thereafter, he was awarded a Ford Foundation Fellowship to pursue an MFA at Stanford, where he created and was named faculty resident of that university's first interdisciplinary art residence. In 79, after a decade as an arts educator and production manager, director, and playwright on Broadway and off, and in major regional theaters, Bob retired from the professional theater and began working with Joseph Campbell, who subsequently asked him to serve as editorial director of his Historical Atlas of World Mythology. In 82, he co-founded Van der Mark Editions to develop and publish not only Campbell's Atlas and numerous other volumes. Over the next 5 years, he continued his work with Campbell while also serving as editorial director of and chief operating officer of Van der Mark Editions, editing and supervising the publication of an array of hardcover, trade paperback, and limited edition titles by, among others, Maria Gimbutas and lots of other important people. At Campbell's death in 87, Bob was named his literary executor, completing unfinished portions of the Atlas and supervising the posthumous publication of Volume 1 and Volume 2. When the Joseph Campbell Foundation was formed in 1990, he was named executive director. As executive director of the collected works of Joseph Campbell in print, audio, and video, he continues to oversee publication of Campbell's works. He was appointed a JCF president in 1998. He's presented papers, seminars, and workshops on five continents, and he and his wife Nola live with their two sons in Marin County, California. Well, Bob, thank you so much. You're a busy man. I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show tonight.
Oh, Karen, it's my pleasure. I'm delighted to join you in a conversation, having spent an all-too-brief time with you at one of the goddess festivals. I just knew we had a conversation that we needed to continue.
Oh, well, you know, you're absolutely right, and I want to thank you for attending my presentation there at Gaia Fest. It was nice looking out at you, seeing you give me the thumbs up and not the thumbs down, so that meant a lot. Well, I mean, I've sort of covered a little bit of, your work with the Joseph Campbell Foundation, but, you know, what can you tell us, on a more personal note about Joseph Campbell, you know, what it was like for you working for him, and what does it mean to you being a part of the foundation?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to say is he was just a hell of a nice guy. He was fun to be around, and that was partly because of an intense curiosity a curiosity, I think, in sense that he had to corral in order to have a career. He kind of got himself in. He would work according to a schedule he set up. When I started with him in the late 70s, he had retired and was working on this historical atlas, but he also engaged in what we called Joe's Friendly Service, which meant that people sent him requests for forewords and would you read this and, you know, could you do this for me? And he was eager and got very excited and very interested in other people's passions. But they got in the way of him getting done what he wanted to do. So he had a routine that he followed when he was in New York. And, you know, he and his wife, Jean Erdman, would awake each morning in a small two-bedroom apartment in Greenwich Village that they'd lived in for 30 years. And their bedroom had become Joe's study, and their bed was then a double bed that doubled as a couch in the living room. Gene would set up a card table each morning and make breakfast, which was about the extent of her culinary art. And they would have breakfast, and then Joe would retire to his study, and Jean would go off to her dance studio. And when we started working, I'd show up each morning around 9, and we would work through the day, take a break routinely, go out usually for a Molson's and a bacon cheeseburger. Joe used to infuriate a lot of progressive people because they would say something to him like, "Well, do you have a special meal or a restricted diet?" And he said, "I have a very, very important diet. It's the Glenlivet and rare roast beef." So he wasn't
too worried about his cholesterol. It doesn't sound like.
No, he wasn't. He wasn't, and he was very active. I mean, he swam almost every day. He walked a lot. He'd always been an athlete. So he took pretty good care of himself, but he ate what he felt like. And so we would fall into this routine. When he was lecturing, I'd stay in New York. And we pushed on with this project, which was the Atlas, even though there was a point at which the entire operation sort of came to a halt, and McGraw-Hill, that was publishing it, let go of the unit that was bringing out the books, and that's shortly about the time that I began to work with him. So he pursued this project, this historical atlas of world mythology that was originally going to be one major volume. He was in his late 70s, and his only condition in working on it had been that he'd do it himself. And I became sort of an extension of his doing it himself, but it was the two of us. I would bring together groups of experts, for example, in early paleontology and so on, to look at what he'd done and have conversations with him about it. But he was the one who made the choices in terms of what he chose to focus on or not. And his scholarship and his curiosity was continuous. And so this book, one-volume book, became two volumes and then became four volumes and then became four volumes in multiple parts. And this from a man in his 80s at that point. So he had this goal and this vision, and he had an outline that he wrote in the beginning, and that outline kind of never varied. It maintained its structure. It just expanded, because as he got into each area, he would realize that, you know, that there was so much that needed to be addressed.
Right.
You know, when he began, it was, he said, well, you know, humankind's story began in Africa. So for the 18 months or 2 years, he started in African prehistory and then came up to the present. And I came along right around then at the point that he realized if he did that, he'd have to do a volume on every continent. And being a comparative mythologist, it was kind of hard to compare. He was constantly bringing in other forces, other voices. So
right. Well, now let me ask you, and you would certainly know better than I think probably the first time I really started paying attention to him was when he had that sit down with Bill Moyers. Mm-hmm. Was he popular to the mainstream world before then, and did he know how important he became to the mainstream?
Absolutely not. He wasn't important to the mainstream. He was important to a lot of individualists pursuing their own creative passions in various disciplines. But he was the renegade scholar, and he didn't. He crossed over disciplines, and so he had no honor in any of them. And initially, at that point, mythology was not a subject thought of as a subject. It was thought of as a tool that belonged to a lot of disciplines. So if you talk to a theologian, they'd say mythology is a subset of what we do. If you talk to a folklorist, they thought they owned mythology. Archaeologists and anthropologists had a different view of mythology, and as did lit crit people. So he was dancing between all these different areas and wasn't thought of as scholarly. He was outside the academy. Although, if you look at his work and the people he knew who were scholars, he was a scrupulous scholar, but he just didn't fit in any of these departments.
Right.
So,
well, he was bridging all of them, where they may be all specialized. Is that the idea?
The bridge is the perfect metaphor. He was translating one perspective to another, and that was not popular. There were these glimmers in the early 80s. Bill Moyers had Bill Moyers Journal, and he interviewed mostly political figures, but not exclusively. And he asked Joe to have a conversation with him, and it was a very rich conversation, so much so that he devoted two programs to it. And then later we learned that he'd gotten something like 10,000 requests for transcripts, which was the most he'd ever gotten. So this kind of caught everybody off guard, because don't forget, we started a publishing company because no one would publish Joseph Campbell.
Okay.
You know, so, I mean, and he has royalties. His royalties at the time that he died from all of the books that he'd done were under $6,000 a year.
Wow. Well, and the way you described the way he was living, he was not rolling in the dough.
Oh, golly, no. He retired from Sarah Lawrence after all these years of teaching with no pension and, you know, needed no essential way to support himself. He began to lecture at that point partly as a source of income. But the lecturing gigs that he got were sporadic, except out here on the coast. On the West Coast, he had a much different profile than he did in the New York intellectual circles. Out here, he found a lot of people, if you will, metaphorically and literally, living on the edge, on the edge of an idea, on the edge of a culture, on the edge of a continent. And there was a discourse, which is why early on, Michael Murphy, in the very early days of Esalen, invited Joe to come down and lecture. So he had people at Esalen and then at the University of California who would invite him back every year, and the Jung Foundation. But these were discrete universes. None of these things had really permeated the culture the way they have now. In fact, Bill Moyers couldn't get the power of, after Joe died, we had all this footage. Let me back you up. There was never an idea to necessarily do those programs. It just was that we really felt those conversations had gone so well that it would be really nice if they had a longer conversation. Bill was still at CBS. Joe had done some video stuff that hadn't panned out. They liked each other, but neither one of them knew sort of what they were doing. And we just got them together finally after a period of time at a dinner and said, how about if, when you're both in the same place, maybe on the West Coast, because Joe was by that time located in Hawaii, maybe you have some conversations and we'll tape them and then we'll see what happens. And so they did several sessions, and then Joe died unexpectedly. And Bill had just gone back to PBS, and he had all this footage, and he said, I'm going to do a six-part conversation with this 80-year-old mythologist. And everybody had public broadcast said, you're going to do what? with who? And he took all his production money that they gave him in this fund when he came back and put out these shows. And in the very beginning, only three channels, as I recall, carried them. But the response was so electric that the next week, about 15 stations came on. They showed episode one while the others showed episode two. And we had arranged for a film called The Hero's Journey, which was a biographical portrait of Joe made in his last years to precede Power of Myth. So that did give some people an idea of who he was. And this audience built and built and built. About the fourth week of the show, I was wandering down Broadway in New York, and out front of Barnes & Noble, someone had set up a folding table, and they'd hand-lettered a sign that said Mythology. And on it was every manner of thing you could think of. There were indigenous tales, there were archaeological books, there was literature, but anything they could, spiritual, anything that they thought could be called mythology, because people were coming in. Now, of course, if you go into a bookstore, you see a shelf sign that says mythology, and it's replete with material. But that's now, and back then, no, it wasn't.
Wow.
It wasn't part of the conversation at all.
Well, and maybe that, it taught to PBS at least that there are people out there that really want some programming of substance rather than reality TV, too.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, wow. PBS has brought it back and back. It's become the single most lucrative fundraising vehicle that they've ever had. And and your listeners would probably be interested to know that that finally after it went out of all of the licenses for the art and things like that in it expired. And we recently, all the people involved in the production got together, and it's been brought up, reissued, new licenses, and I'm a hopeful that it will actually air on PBS again. I know Bill Moyers has been talking to people about, what's it like 20 years after he first did it. So it's going to be born anew for a whole other generation. So it'll be very interesting to see, see what kind of energy that brings up in the body politic.
Wow. Well, that's really good to know. I love those shows. I could watch them over and over again because they're so dense with information that sort of just makes your brain connect one dot to another, to another, to another, that, you can listen to them over and over and hear something new, I think, every time. They're just incredible.
Well, and also a good part of that is Bill's is their presence together. I mean, Bill, the son of a Baptist preacher, asked these very insightful questions, and you can almost see the twinkle in Joe's eye as he answers them. And it's also part of the edit, because Bill had a masterful way. Don't forget, this is 6 hours of some, I would guess 20 hours that they filmed, maybe. Bill had a wonderful way of pulling the essence of Joe, the aphorism or the essential story out of Joe's response, and never changing the response, but really helping sharpen it for in a way that came across. But then Joe did that when he talked to you, and if you asked him a specific question, the more specific your question, the more direct his answer.
Well, yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because I thought, what an incredible team they made, because Bill Moyers knew what he was talking about. He wasn't just some interviewer on the other end with a list of questions, and there was no follow-up,
right,
to an answer. I mean, they were really having a dialogue.
Part of the thing that was under that, Karen, is that when the original idea was hatched, one of the things that Bill had said is he didn't want to just do a series of talking head interviews, and he wanted something that had substance and sweep. And, of course, we were able to say, hey, want substance and sweep? Joe is working on a historical atlas of world mythology. And so Bill did, look at the material ahead of time, and, in fact, material that even to this day hasn't been released. I said to you, for example, he wrote Africa to the Present. Well, all we ended up doing was the early prehistory of Africa. The rest of the material he has set aside, we still have it. You know, hopefully it will be published at some point, but, you know, that was there. And so we kind of opened up all of the work that Joe was working on with the Atlas, and that helped launch the conversation. But then Bill had really schooled himself in terms of looking at Hero with a Thousand Faces and some of Joe's other work, so that he had an arsenal of questions and a perspective, and could be informed.
Right. Well, and I'm thinking, too, what I really liked about it, at least for myself, was because they made this relevant. You know, it wasn't like it was just, oh, something people did thousands of years ago. I mean, they really made people understand why we should care about this today, why we're still living this. And I'm not sure a lot of people even still get that.
Sure, there's a wonderful moment where Bill says, you know, here now, and Joe says, yes, Bill, you, here now. it's right. This is not about something, you know, this is not about something dusty from the past. This is about what moves you right here, right now.
Well, I'm certainly glad you're continuing to get his work out there. I mean, let me ask you this. I mean, are you sort of his, I guess, his surrogate, his replacement? I mean, can we look to you as sort of, you know, to carry the torch? Are you the next Joseph Campbell?
Oh, golly, no. No, we are. I've danced with him and his work now for three decades or more, but I'm not the only one who has. I have areas in which I'm really very, very informed, and had insight or work or studies of my own that I brought to the conversation. But then there's other areas that I'll give you an example. I mean, I read Portrait of an Artist at one point, but I would never have thought of myself as being, you know, a Joycean. And then one of the first things we did in the posthuma was that Joe had all these years of work with James Joyce, and I thought, you know, as a person who's interested but doesn't really grasp this material, let me dive into Joe's material and see if he can provide me with a sort of reader's guide to James Joyce. And so I spent a few years working on that material with sort of Joe at my elbow. And then we brought in a Joycean scholar who smoothed it out and referenced the work that's gone on since Joe had, you know, initially encountered this material, which was 30 years, some years before his death. When you right at the time that you know Ulysses was coming out, so he was able to lead me into that. Now I know a hell of a lot more about Joyce than I ever did before.
Right.
But then there are large areas of the material where I turn to the Eddie Epsteins, and I turn to my colleagues like David Miller on the board, who's an emeritus professor of religion, and work with Joe and Rollo May on these wine cellar conversations, and you know. David's probably forgotten way more about you know, philosophy and theology than I knew. But on the other hand, Joe was a born and raised Catholic. I was born and raised Catholic. I was in a Jesuit seminary. Well, we had this kind of common language as a base, but I would never presume to be, you know, the Watson Gupta professor of religion, so to speak.
Right. What were Joe's credentials?
Well, you know, Joe was, I guess you'd say, an English teacher. He had a master's. When he went to Europe, it was to study Romance and the Grail, and he had all these epiphanies, including coming into contact with the work of Joyce and other modernists, and then that took him. He discovered that the early Romance work was done by Germans, so he applied for an extra year and went to Germany, and then that got him involved with the German philosophers and Mann and people that would later animate him. But he was, he came back to Colombia, and he said, this whole thing has opened up. I see these Eastern influences coming into the Grail, and I see, you know, all of these other ramifications. And they said, whoa, you know. Write a narrow thesis. and stick to your doctoral topic, and you know, which was an extension of his master's about the sort of wounded king, and he just said, I can't do that. I can't like put it back in the box, and so he walked. He walked away from it, and then ended up at Sarah Lawrence teaching, English, if you will, or literature, and then began to develop this, this interest in mythology. Then taught this sort of course in mythology. But you can see him even in his 50s in his journals, which we've published, when he went to India and Asia for the first time after having been immersed in this material. He's still saying, gee, what do I want to do? Do I want to be I can't imagine just being a teacher, but I can't imagine saying that the insights that I've experienced that you're going to find in books.
And an English teacher, of all things.
Yeah, almost. You could essentially say an English teacher, a literature teacher.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Well, so we're so lucky for his curiosity.
Exactly.
So do scholars look differently at him now? Do they look at him with more respect, or they still have a problem, with the fact that he was a little unorthodox?
It's not either or. I think it's safe to say that there are some very major scholars in certain areas who followed him to the grave, arguing to the grave that he was absolutely wrong and knew nothing. I'll give you a practicum. When in the early 90s, after the foundation was started, we called together our advisors and directors and said, we know what we're going to do to preserve, protect, and perpetuate the work of Joseph Campbell, but his larger work was mythology, and we would like to bring mythology into the academy. And what can we do to further that study? Because at that point, there was no place you could get a degree in it, or no place that there was even a path of study. So, again, David Miller, who I mentioned, I asked David if he would work, and we identified 100 academics who were using mythology in one way or another in courses they taught or had used it heavily in their published work. And we sent them all an invitation. And we said, we the foundation are trying to explore to see how we can further the field of mythology. And we invite you to come, all expenses paid, to a weekend in California, and to engage with your colleagues in a discussion about how this best might be done, and to advise us at the foundation so that we proceed in a reasonable manner. About half of the people failed to respond. Of the, say, half who did respond, about half of them said, I wouldn't cross the street to have anything to do with anything that had Joseph Campbell's name on it. Now we're down to dozen, and a few of them started putting down conditions, saying, "Well, I'd be glad to come just as long as you don't invite over there, because those people, they don't get it,
Okay.
We really get it.
Were they saying just don't quote me?
Yeah,
I'm not really there.
So we ended up with about 12 people who came together, represented an array of disciplines. And some interesting things came out of that, some of which have endured. One was, if you want to further mythology, then for the time being, keep Joseph Campbell's name away from it, because right now, with all of his popularity and celebrity, that will undermine your scholarly credibility. The second was, we need a place where people can actually get a degree. And they talked about younger students that they'd had who had cited Campbell in a master's thesis or a doctoral dissertation and had gotten completely, devastated for it, had to redo their thesis. And they talked about other people who had, there was no place to publish. So like one young scholar had, desperate to publish, had published a piece in Parabola. But Parabola was not considered a scholarly thing. So when he came up for tenure, he was denied tenure because he published in popularist journals, but there was no other place for him to do it.
Right.
So a journal was started.
And is that still going on? Is that still going on?
No, now it started to change. A journal has started, an actual course at Pacifica Graduate Institute where you can now get master's and doctoral in mythology started, and a handful of these same teachers ultimately established that program, which now has a couple, has spawned several hundred graduates to animate the field. We now have younger professors for whom the idea of crossing into another discipline is not frightening, and it's not held against them. This has just been, when I was asked to be faculty resident way back in the early 70s at Stanford, it was because, who was I? I was this little Ford fellow there. But, I was working with people in different disciplines, and none of the big guns wanted to or thought there was value in that. The music department was the music department.
Well, now let me ask you this, and I guess I'm I guess I just think differently. But if you sort of, what was the word you used? If you sort of cross over or bridge
right.
disciplines, doesn't that just sort of open up the box wider? It seems like that gives you a wider perspective than a narrow perspective.
It absolutely does, but we mustn't forget that the game of the academy is getting narrower and narrower and narrower. So you find your specialty within your specialty, and you get an advisor who's the expert in that area, and then you refine his or her work further. And, the academies always work the other way.
I see. Okay.
See what I'm
well,
saying?
I think I've had a problem with that.
A lot of people have, and it's driven some of the more creative minds away from. That's when you get those who can't do teach. Why do they teach? Because they can't get along with anybody else. They got such a little focus on such a tiny little area that if they don't have a room full of people for whom that's their sole focus, they don't know what to say.
Right. Well, I want to, start shifting over, sort of into the work, but I'm afraid I'm going to forget to ask you this, so let me just get this out of the way now. For listeners who may be new to this, or maybe they've heard of Joseph Campbell and heard good things, where would they start? I mean, there's such a huge body of work out there. I mean, what would you, maybe especially if you're a goddess advocate and you're also interested in Maria Gimbutas, who Joseph, I think, thought her work was good. Of Joe's works, where do they start?
Well, I think a good place, one comfortable place we've already talked about, take a look at The Power of Myth. It's an engaging piece of video. It's now available on video. Again, on DVD, it can also be downloaded. Then, extending video, there is The Hero's Journey, which is a biographical portrait of Campbell and his work. And then there's a film called Sukhavati, which is has a lot of goddess material in it, and it's called A Mythic Journey with Joseph Campbell. And then there is a series called Mythos, parts 1 and 2. We just finished part 3. The mostly goddess and early prehistory is in Mythos 1. These are a series of lectures that Joe filmed. We filmed with Joe in the early 80s, and only a month ago, we finally wrapped the third volume, and it'll be out this fall. Susan Sarandon was the narrator on all of that. So that's all video, if your way of engaging the material is visual. If you're of a literary bent, then I recommend that you dip your toe in through essays. There are three significant essay books. One is Myths to Live By. It was published in 1972. It's available in paperback, and in fact, we will be bringing out the very first ebook in the Joseph Campbell collection. Is an enhanced version of Myths to Live By, and that'll be available very soon. Information on all of this, Karen, is at jcf.org, the Joseph Campbell Foundation website. There's also threaded conversations there. In the part called the Associates area, you we don't do anything with your name, but you need to sign up as an associate to access the back end and some of the deals and some of the stuff like that and these conversations. But there have been tens of thousands of posts over the last 15 years about different subjects. Some of them are the sacred feminine, you know, the hero's journey. You can find threads on a lot of things.
Okay.
So that's one way to read. But then Myths to Live By or The Mythic Dimension. In The Mythic Dimension is a seminal essay called The Sacred Number of the Goddess that was one of the last things he did. And then an earlier group of essays that he did is called Flight of the Wild Gander. So Myths to Live By, however, I think is really most interesting because it touches on a lot of his interest in East and West, his interest in prehistory, and it goes up through the spacewalk. There's a wonderfully illuminating essay on his work with John Weir Perry on schizophrenia and mysticism and where mythology fits in that. And then his thoughts on the mythologies of the future that will emerge and what he thinks are some of the critical themes that are going to have to be in there, the mythic memes upon which that's going to be built. And those essays he wrote around the time of the initial space shots. So it's a wide, it gives you a lot of a sense of the breadth of his curiosity and his understanding of mythology, which was very broad.
He must have been an interesting guy to be married to. I bet they never turned on the television.
They didn't own a television.
They
didn't own a television. They didn't subscribe to any magazines. They didn't read the newspaper. He didn't listen to the radio.
Wow.
Now, this is a guy. In fact, this is another, what's Joseph Campbell like? After he died, I put together, I invited a lot of the people that he knew who were also well-known. We did a large public memorial at the American Museum of Natural History. And one of the things I said to Gene is, you know, I said, Gene, I'm music. What, you know, you're a dancer. What kind of music? You know, I now that I think about it, you know, Joe played in a jazz band. He put himself through college by playing in a jazz band, and yet I'd never heard music, and I'd never heard him talk about music. And she said, he gave that up 20 years ago. And I said, what? And she said, no. She said, at one point, he put down his horn, and he said, I can't do that. I'm going to have to let that go. And she said,
No time, right.
And he had such concern and passion about music that he couldn't just put it on in the background. And so she would be like working on a new dance. She had a little cassette recorder, and when he, on the nights that he was working late in his study, she'd be in the living room, and she'd hold the cassette to her ear, because if she played the music loudly, it would distract him. And if he walked in and saw her with the cassette, he'd say, oh, you're working. And he would go away, because so the answer was, you know, there wasn't any music right then that spoke to him. So
wow.
He was an example, though, of when he was a young man, in his journals, he talks about wanting to write an outline of everything, in which he relates a toothbrush to philosophy, a toothbrush to Buddhism. I mean, he had this idea that somehow he could come up with this grand scheme of a sort of a glass bead game, almost, in terms of how everything kind of fit together. And it was fascinating guy to be around as a result.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, he must have, well, I'm guessing, and maybe I'm projecting a little bit here. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like there's never going to be enough time in this life to learn everything I want to learn.
Absolutely.
I can just imagine for him that must have been a thousandfold.
Oh, it was. It was constant. And I mean, when I started working with him, I thought I was just going to work on this historical atlas and help him get that together. But it was so clear to me that, you know, every day another half a dozen books would arrive. You know, there'd be all these phone messages, and he'd get all this mail, and he was feeling this obligation to respond to it. And, you know, there was one day this huge book arrived Helen and Kurt Wolf had published this book by Arno Schmidt called Evening Etched in Gold, and it was like, I don't know, 24 inches high by, you know, 15 inches wide, and you opened it up, and it looked like something like TypeScript, but there were marginalia and hand notations and, you know, meta talk about it. And Joe just opened it and looked at it and closed it and pushed it across the table to me and said, "You can have this if you want. I already spent 3 years of my life working on an indecipherable book," which was Finnegan's Wake. But everything like that, he knew that if he really dipped his toe in, he'd get sucked in.
Well, and it sounds like he was a guy who didn't do things halfway. You know, he really got in and dug deep.
That's right. He didn't pretend to listen to you. He really did.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, 3 weeks later, he'd say, I just had this idea. I have to tell Alan about it.
Well, now, you mentioned, we sort of briefly touched on Maria Gimbutas. The few quotes I've read in his reference to her, he said he wished he had found her work sooner. It was like a Rosetta Stone. Was he an advocate of her work where so many weren't?
Oh, totally. In fact, you know, when we decided to start Vandermark Editions, we'd been turned down by every publisher in the business more than once. Nobody was interested in what he was working on. And so we had a dinner at the New York Athletic Club, Fred Vandermark, his Once Upon a Time McGraw-Hill publisher, and I and Joe. And Joe said, "We have to do this ourselves." And Fred said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "We'll have to start our publishing company. You know, Bob's the editor, you're the publisher, I'm the writer." And Fred said, "Joe, you can't have a publishing company with just one author and one book." And he said, "Oh." He said, "There's hundreds of books. There's hundreds of books that need to be written. Bob and I will give you a list." And we went, you know, the next morning, he said, "Well, we got to do that list for Fred." And we started writing down all the different books and subjects that he thought needed to be talked about and written about. And at the top of the list was Maria's work. And he said, "She's got all this other stuff, and we've got it. You know, we've just got it. We've got to do something with that." And on it went. When he saw her work, it gave in his mind scientific credibility. And even though, admittedly, you know, she was also a renegade in the academy. But it gave scientific insight. She gave scientific insight into what he had been intuiting and talking about.
Now, they never met each other, right?
Oh, they absolutely knew each other very well.
Oh, okay.
You know, they knew each other very well, and that's why we ended up, you know, working with Maria. She had a book that Harper was trying to put together, and they didn't know what to do with it because there were, like, thousands of pieces of pottery and stuff. It was a mind-boggling design issue. And so at that point, we brought it over to Vandermark and took on the task of putting it together. And through those years, they saw each other quite a bit.
Well, you know, I can't help but think after all of the, the negative feedback she got, it must have really just did her heart and soul good to have Joe appreciate her research.
Well, she did. You know, he did the preface for that book. And he did the foreword, and in fact, when we put the Joseph Campbell Archive and Library at Pacifica Graduate Institute, which is where, you know, they've developed the courses in mythology or the degree programs in mythology. Campbell was at the height of his celebrity, and there was a lot of press around that, and then shortly thereafter, Maria died. And the executors of her estate were looking around for what to do with her papers and things, and they took them to Pacifica, and Pacifica said, "What do you guys think?" And we said, "Absolutely," and we changed the name to the Joseph Campbell and Maria Gimbutas Archive and Library.
Right.
You know, and that was in recognition of this resonance that had developed between these two people, and
right.
The fact that both of them had suffered the slings and arrows, if you will, of the academy in their quest for what they believed to be true.
Right. I don't know. I guess, you know, I'm just the nonconformist, but give me the renegades any day. I always like them better.
Me too.
Well, okay, so let's start, you know, getting into the work. Well, first, I wanted to ask you, I was doing research on you and Joe and, you know, really trying to go above and beyond to prepare for tonight, because I wanted to ask you some juicy stuff.
Okay.
And I saw you've been called a myth activist, and I liked that. And I was hoping, do you know you're called a myth activist, and what do you mean?
And also a mischief maker.
I bet. So what is a myth activist, Bob?
Well, to me, it's fundamentally important that each of us understands the mythos in which we live, the mythology that animates us. And so first level for me of being a myth activist is insisting on the importance of individuals understanding really their deep story, their deep understanding of who they are mythically. Going into Joe, almost every lecture Joe ever did, at one point or another, he says something like, the four functions of mythology are, that in our irreverent moments, you know, our mischief-making moments, we used to say, you know, we should just make a Joseph Campbell wind-up doll, and when you wind it up, he would say, the four functions of mythology are.
But, well, tell us, what are they?
Yeah, well, let me do that for a minute, but let me cast it slightly differently and maybe to answer a bit of your... I don't want to talk about the four functions so much as I want to talk about the four ways in which a viable mythology connects a person, centers a person, puts them in touch with their mythic identity. And so, Joe always started with this idea of a mythology describes a mystical understanding of the world. Well, you know, that might have been easy to live into if you lived in the Renaissance or you lived in a tribe that's isolated where all of your actions were reflective of and reflecting of the mythos. We don't have that now. So I like to start it the other way. And the first function of a mythology, or the first way a mythology connects you, is it connects you psychologically. It tells you a bit about who you are on your own individual psychological journey, from, you know, child to adolescent to, you know, 20-something, pre-adult to adult, to, you know, an elder to your grave, and that on that level, most mythologies have not changed very, very much, because in the at least in the 30-something thousand years of human history of which we're aware, the human brain hasn't changed that much. The human animal hasn't changed that much.
So are you talking about which archetypes we play out in
yes,
our myths?
Yes.
Is that what you're... Okay.
Well, the archetypes in one sense and the unique reflection, unique inflections of those archetypes, okay? Because the archetype is always... know, is the elementary idea. It always appears cloaked and garbed in a Volkgedanken, in a folk idea, in the garb of a particular culture in a particular place. So it means something very different to be, you know, a 14-year-old in Ethiopia than it does to be a 14-year-old in, you know, here in Marin County. And yet on another level, they're both 14, okay? So
mm-hmm.
The archetype is playing out in a different way. So the mythology that's viable for you, that is one that connects you to a real strong sense of where you are psychologically, who in your own development. You know, you're not a kid trying to be an adult. You're not, you know, not some, you know, some adult who really wishes they were 16 again and, you know, acts out like that. But your own story of yourself has you in a sort of appropriate place. So you're connected to yourself psychologically through the myth that animates you. And then the second way it connects you is that it connects you in terms of sociologically, telling you what your function is sociologically in your society. Now, part of that is again, universal, parent, child, but it also is what you do. and how your society relates to you. We talked about we like the people who are sort of the renegades, right? Well, that's a sort of social function that's very different from the keeper of the truth that is the academy. So how you are associated in your society, and in the Renaissance or in an intact sort of isolated mythological perspective, that's pretty clear. You're told what you are. We still see that in many tribal cultures, you know, where we see, for example, women being, you know, treated in a certain way and told how they have to be in order to be a part of that society, and a very different definition of the feminine in another society. So, and a different, you know, and you can see it if you want, if you talk in terms of the feminine archetype, it has different, you know, different nuances in each culture.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the second way a myth connects you sociologically. Now, those societies again are all in collision with each other right now. So all of those once upon a time very secure, comprehensible, defined mythological roles of a person in a society are all up for grabs. Because you see all kinds of different manifestations of that now. So it's necessary for a person in the formulation of their own mythic identity to be connected somehow to some society that makes sense to them.
Right. Is that why we're having such culture wars here in the United States?
Absolutely. Let's come back to that, because part of that is change in the trickster and our desire for certainty. Yes, part of that is that it's no longer clear what it means to be a man, what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a contributing member of a society. You could look at, for example, all of the problems with Islam and jihad. And are you a martyr? Are you a terrorist?
Right.
That's a pretty black and white, but you can extrapolate out from that.
Mm-hmm.
The third way then that the mythology connects you, and this is where a lot of the trouble comes in, is cosmologically. So the mythology gives you a sense of you and your society in the great universe. And Joe liked to say there's nothing wrong with the mythologies of 2,000 years ago, but there's everything wrong with their cosmologies. You know, we now know that, you know, that the sun does not revolve around the earth. We know that the earth itself, in fact, is not flat. We have a very different understanding of the universe today. It's not a Newtonian universe of cause and effect. It isn't. You know, to trace it back to an ultimate cause, and you know, we can't. We now see that the universe is this field of energy that when observed changes, and that the observer changes it. It's a dynamic. It's a different view of the cosmos and of the world. And a lot of the mythologies fall apart right there.
Creation story is debunked, basically. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. And every culture has these stories in which they've created their understanding of the cosmology and personified it. If you think about the ones that are familiar to a lot of people, the Greeks, the Romans, the Egyptians, you've got cosmological forces and deities and primal urges and their whole stories are played out like this. And it's sometimes very hard to reconcile those with the scientific understanding of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you can also read things like the Dancing Wooly Masters or start to talk to particle physicists or start to talk to, they start to sound like poets and mystics, because their understanding of the wondrous, magical, mysterious cosmos is so animated and informed. It's not in cognitive dissonance with a story that one might feel comfortable with when you're a child.
Okay.
Now, we can touch back on what we were saying before. If that scares the shit out of you, you're going to retreat.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to retreat into orthodoxy. You're going to retreat into literalism. You're going to retreat to a position where you only want somebody to tell you what to do in the face of this awesome cosmos that threatens to overwhelm you. And that's what you see happening now for a lot of people. As the world changes faster and faster, and more people who are not like them at all, you know, collide against them, bump up against them, they want security. They want to retreat to a village compound. They want an ordered universe where, you know, we don't believe in cosmic, you know, in the fact that the Earth is warming. You know?
Or they want to demonize another religion or somebody of another color or something
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. Put it all out there. So now, but if returning to these four, if in fact you are connected psychologically and sociologically grounded and you have a sense of this cosmos as filling you with awe and wonder and mystery, and you feel connected to that too as a result, you know, you look up at the night sky and it doesn't terrify you. You know, it's a mystery, tremendous and fascinating, that you realize you'll never be able to fully comprehend, and that's okay. Well, then it's like three cherries lining up on a slot machine. And all
you know what you're describing. I've been reading
yeah.
a lot of political stuff recently, and you're describing the difference between the liberal and the conservative brain.
Well, you know, you can look at it through that lens.
Yeah. Okay. So they were talking about that the conservative brain is physically, you know, is literally fear based.
Yes.
Anyway, but I'm sorry.
Well,
go ahead.
Okay. Well, anyway, what happens then is, you know, we say, you know, magic is, God is alive, magic is afoot. Your world is in fact sort of mystically infused. Everything makes sense. You feel like you are in the center of your universe as you understand it, and intimately connected on all these different levels to yourself, your society, you know, the cosmos. That's a mystical understanding. So then you're living in a mytho. You're living a mythic identity, and when you have some security in that mythic identity, well, then the temporal changes that come and go, they don't upset you the same way.
Right.
And you know, that's the, you know, Joe's, you know, somewhat flippant definition of mythology was another person's religion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, it's, you know, it's my religion, but for you, I'm a mythology. And,
right.
And if you stand in that position and you think of religion as being the thing that, you know, lashes you back. I mean, the roots of the word. It ties you back. It pulls you into this sort of centered place, and provides a reason for you doing what you do. You can understand this same idea that you're living from a mythic perspective in which you feel connected as opposed to disconnected. Now, when that's great to say, okay, but we all make wonderful plans, and then, you know, the dog comes along and lifts his leg. I mean, we have the Book of Job, we have the Buddha, you know, all life is sorrowful, you know, everything happens. So things happen, and we believe that we want to believe, you know, nowadays that, well, we're so evolved that we can control everything so that it, you know, it doesn't, you know, happenstancely to us. But life does. And, you know, in all the mythologies, you have these trickster characters who are personifications of this disruptive force that comes along. You know, they're that expression of the best laid plans of mice and men. As soon as you think you got it set up, foolish mortal that you are, you know, the trickster is going to come along and change it on you. And that's a fundamental part of every mythological tradition. And when you read a lot of the mythological stories, you see this happening over and over again. And it's typically dealt with humorously. It's dealt with as, there we go again. You know, Joe liked to say, if you've got that humor there, that recognition of the bathos, the humor and agony of the human condition, then you've got mythology. And if it's not there, you've got theology.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's a subtle difference, but it's a really important difference. And if you look at the Hopi story, you know, why at the most sacred part of Hopi ceremonials do the clowns come in? Exactly the reason.
So it doesn't turn into theology. So it doesn't become this this rigid dogma. Is that another way to put it?
Yes. Yes, because the mystical, mythic insight, the connection, it can't be literalized. It can't be contained. As soon as you try to contain it, it goes away.
Yeah, that's when it becomes the dogma.
Exactly. My friend, brother David Sendel Roth, he used to always come in and join me at my Esalen workshop in the years he was there, and invariably someone would say to him, why is it that this great spiritual passion that we all share in this spiritual connection turns into these religions, capital R, horrible things that do all these things? And Brother David says, it's a function of human compassion. Yeah, and here's how he tells the story. He says, okay, you wake up one morning, you know, maybe this bird sounds, something happens, it gets you out of bed, and you walk over to the window, and just at that particular moment, the sun comes over the hill, and your clock radio starts playing this Brahms concerto, and your automatic coffee makers just come on, and you get this whiff of coffee, and there's just this moment in which you, like, float. You're transformed. You have this, wow, I'm alive. It's great. It's wonderful. Look at this. But those are just putting words to it. But you've had this experience. Well, what do you do with it? In order to prove to yourself you have it, and because you're a good person, you run next door to Joe. And you say, Joe, guess what? I just woke up this morning, and, you know, and my clock radio went off, and there was this Brahms playing, and my coffee maker went off, and I went to the window, and I put back the curtain, and the sun came over the mountain, and Joe, I was so high. I had this experience, you know, everything was right with the world. It was just, I had to share it with you. So you go back home, what did Joe do? He sets his clock, he looks in the, and says, okay, tomorrow morning the sun comes up at 6:14. Okay, so he sets his clock radio for 6:14, and he puts his iPod in because he really wants Brahms.
And, he's indoctrinated.
Exactly, and of course, what happens is, alarm clock goes off. He goes to the window. The sun doesn't come up, or comes up. You know, he hears Brahms. He hears the coffee maker. Nothing, and he goes. And next time he sees me, he says, "Hey, Bob, you know, come on, give me the truth. What happened? You know." I did everything you said and nothing happened. So what am I going to say? I'm going to say, geez, Joe, which way does your window face? You know, because it's really got to face northeast. And and what kind of coffee did you – what piece of Brahms was that? You know, no. I had the fifth concerto. You only had the third concerto. Why don't you try the third, you know? And pretty soon, out of human compassion, this stuff starts to codify.
I see. You know? And I see the compassion, what you're saying now, because you're trying to help him achieve what you experienced.
And share it. And it's also validating me. I mean,
right.
There's a certain selfish gene in there.
Right.
It's the human instinct, and the human instinct is we don't really know what we know until we talk about it. We share. There was this experiment that I read about, and I'm trying to find the source because I've cited first camp like 20 years ago, and maybe somebody can help me and come up with it. But they took a class of preschool kids, about 24 kids, and they divided them in half. Half the kids they took to the zoo, and the other half of the kids just stayed in the classroom, had a normal class. But now when they went to the zoo, you know, they went through the zoo, but they didn't talk about it at all. They just went back, and the next day class happened, and everybody was back together. And they waited about, I think, a week, 10 days. And then they split the class in half. So they took half of the kids who went to the zoo and half of the kids who didn't, and they went off with one aide and teacher, and half of the kid, the other half went off with another. Well, one group, the teachers and the aides said, hey, do you remember when we went to the zoo? And they started talking about these stories and what the elephant did and what the monkey did and all this other stuff. The other half of the class, which, remember, is made up of one quarter of the kids who went to the zoo and one quarter of the kids who didn't, they just had a different afternoon. They didn't talk about the zoo or anything. And then they let another 4 or 5 days pass, and they gave the kids a sort of interview about going to the zoo. Well, almost every single kid who'd been in the group where they talked about going to the zoo talked about having been to the zoo, even though half of them had never been there. And equally remarkable, of the kids for whom they had not talked to them about going to the zoo, to a person, the kids who had been to the zoo did not remember having gone there. So in other words, it's in the telling of the tale. It's in the feedback loop, in the putting it into word, into form, into action, into ritual, into dance, into some kind of shape that we become aware of what we're aware of. And if we aren't given any opportunity to do that, and this brings me back to why am I a myth activist? Well, if our life is completely circumscribed by other people's stories, other people's realities, okay, if it's all played out in that stage, we're never given an opportunity to even figure out what our own mythic identity is.
Right.
So
right.
No reason. It's totally understandable that we become unmoored when aspect of our construct doesn't work.
So does that mean, and if, let's just say, for instance, I mean, like myself, you know, I grew up a Catholic in the Bible Belt.
Right.
I really, you know, I sort of had my mythic identity thrust upon me as opposed to actually maybe finding my own.
Right.
I mean, is that what we're talking about when we sort of get born into a religion?
Yes. And if we don't make it our own, what happens at a certain point? We were both born and raised Catholic, and so was Joe. So, you know, we actually published a book called Thou Art That he and I had worked on when he was alive, but at that point we called it Myths and Symbols of the Christian Faith. And he said, you know, his point was that all of these mythic symbols and images, the narratives that are implied by them, that come into you as a child, they don't go away. You can't just suddenly wake up one morning and say, well, that's not, you know, forget it, because it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to transform it in some way.
Right.
You know, you have to read it in a different way. You know, so he liked to pick on certain tenets of Christianity. One of the things in Inner Reaches of Outer Space, the last little book he wrote, he takes off on the assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And he said, now, okay, you know, I heard a little about this when I was a kid. You know, and then I learned the speed of light. Well, you know, if a body was assumed into heaven and it was traveling at the speed of light and she was assumed into heaven on this date, light travels at this speed. And then he does this whole mathematical equation to determine how many, you know, millions or billions of miles she might have traveled, and concludes that at this particular point she's just passing out of the solar system. And so he says, now, what is a rational mind to do with this?
Mm-hmm.
But then he turns it around and he talks about what does the assumption mean metaphorically. And then he goes from there into similar metaphoric insight in other cultures.
Really can only take these myths metaphorically because scientifically they just break down.
Right. And as soon as you try to make them concrete, you get dogma and you get all the stuff that's going on right now. Look at it. We've got Christians. We've got, once upon a time, all of the lore that is in the Bible right now, the book that animates the people of the book, was oral tradition. Mm-hmm. And then it got written down. And then it got written down. And guess what? It got passed from one language to another. And scholars to this day fight over it. And Islam and Judaism and Catholicism, Christianity, are killing each other. Adherents of those interpretations of this same book, you know, have been at each other, killing each other, rivers of blood for centuries.
Well, and if anybody's ever played the telephone game.
Well, exactly. I do that in a lecture. I'll start something in the lecture, and I'll say, okay. And then I go on and give my lecture. And then, you know, near the end, I say, what did I say? And I said, now imagine if each one of you whispering to the other was a generation. Yeah? And
right.
That doesn't even begin to get us as far back as we're talking about now.
Right.
Now, one more thing, Kat, before we move on, because, and that is, when I talk about being a myth activist and the need for a mythic identity, the issue for me is, you can almost boil down, if you had, you know, one or two things that you wanted to put there, that you wanted to make it through that telephone game of generations, what would they be? And one of the things you quickly understand is they would be pretty damn simple.
I think I lost you. Say that one more time.
Well, if you had to pull, you know, the insights of your lifetime into one, you know, one story that you told and that you, you know, told to someone and that you hoped they would tell to someone and someone and someone, generation to generation, just like the
right.
telephone game, you would have to make it concise and simple.
Right.
Okay? Because
right.
the rest of the edges would go away. And
right.
so when people read a lot of the mythologies, particularly of what we now would call primal people, once upon a time primitive people, you go, oh, my God, this is so simple and naive. Well, yes. Yes. For this reason. And so now, can you look at it metaphorically and can you let it open out in your understanding of what they were trying to touch? Because all of these stories touch upon something.
A universal truth,
something
kind
that you
of.
Can't...
Or...
Say again?
They sort of touch on a specific idea, and it's just a lot of fill around the edges to perpetuate that idea.
Well, and they are metaphors. So they,
right.
they use aspects of the person's real life experience to talk about something that they can't otherwise talk about. Okay? So like when Campbell came up, you know, really the second half of Campbell's life was given over to this idea that, okay, if there are these universals, these archetypes, and if they're common to the human experience, why are they expressed differently in different places? Why do they come up as folk ideas in these different costumes? And he would say, you know, it's because of the geography of the people and their state of cultural development. So if you are a people who've lived in the desert, then you're going to be able to read stories from other people who live in a desert in a very different way than someone who, say, lives by a sea and has never seen a desert.
Right.
Or take mountain or take river or take any other aspect of the natural phenomenon, because these stories were built out of what our forebears perceived.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, all right, so Bob, so let's take this a little bit further. So if a person understands, I guess then you'd call it the psychology of myth and how it can so quickly turn into a religion, where does that leave people, for instance, you know, an atheist, I mean?
Well, you know, an atheist in a certain sense is you know, has a... I think you could talk about, listen to this, I think you could talk about secular mythologies. In other words, I think you could talk about things that a theist would call God, and that an atheist would call some other unifying principle that they hold. In that case, that there is no God. That becomes the central cosmological, you know, mystical insight. Communism, one can think of as a mythology. There's no God in there consciously, but there is this overarching grand idea of the communist ideal, whether it's, you know, the shorthand from, you know, each according to ability, each according to means. There's an ideology in there, a belief.
Whether it has a spiritual component or not.
Correct. Now, I would maintain to you that the ones that endure and that have the greatest legs are the ones that speak to that spiritual element of the human condition. You know, because that's what most people experience.
So how does a person who understands the psychology of myth, how can they also reconcile that with believing in deity, or can they? Are they constantly in conflict in their mind?
Oh, I don't think you have to be in conflict. When Joe was sick in the hospital at the very last, he's getting radiation treatment, there was an Irish Catholic priest that came in and said, "Mr. Campbell, do you wish to pray with me?" And Joe said, "Well, not really, but I will." And he said, "Well, would you like to talk about God?" And Joe said, "Of course. Do you want to talk about God with form or without form?" Okay? So, So that's the answer, in my mind, is, you know, you can, you know, you're talking about ineffables, unknowables. You can put them with form or without. There's the Meister Eckhart is saying the most important things can't be spoken about, and the next most important things are misunderstood. Why are they misunderstood? Because you're trying to talk about something that you can't talk about, and you're talking about it in a manner where, you know, other people are going to misunderstand it. And then there's all the rest of the stuff, which is 90% of what we talk about.
So you're saying it's because it's really unknowable.
It's unknowable, and you're trying to express it in a metaphoric way that will connect with the other person.
Right.
I'll give you a great example. when I was lecturing in Brazil for the first time, working with a translator, and I'll spare you the setup, but I was telling the story of Joe Campbell being on a radio show when we were doing the Atlas, and how the host was kept telling him myth is a lie, and Joe kept saying myth is a metaphor. And this went on for an hour. And near the very end of the show, as the clock was ticking down, Joe said he suddenly realized this guy didn't know what a metaphor was. So he said, "Give me an example of a metaphor." And Joe, and the guy said, "You." And he said, no, I'm the teacher now. I didn't teach for all these years. You know, you give me an example of a metaphor." And he said, "You know, it was cruel to do this to a guy on his own radio show." And he started sweating, and the clock is ticking down. He's got like 1 minute left, and he says, "Okay, John runs fast. John is like a deer." And Joe says, "No, that's not a metaphor. That's a simile." And he goes, "No." Well, he says, "It is." And Joe says, "The metaphor is John runs fast. John is a deer." And the guy says, "That's a lie." And Joe says, "That's a metaphor."
A metaphor.
And that's the end of the show, okay? So I'm telling this anecdote with a translator in front of an audience of about 1,500 people. And I get... John's like a deer, and there's kind of this ripple that goes through the audience, and I give the punchline, and the ripple kind of intensifies, and my now friend and then translator and continue, he covers the mic and he leans over and he says, "Bob, we have a problem." And I said, "What?" And he said, "In Portuguese, Brazilian Portuguese anyway, deer is slang for homosexual." And I went, "Oh!" And I said, "So then I said, I understand why you're all reacting like that. How about if I said, John runs fast, John is a jaguar?" And everyone went, "Oh!" Well, you know, you learn quickly. I kept that in every other lecture I gave because it just spoke perfectly to the problem. The problem, you know, metaphor provides this opportunity. Mythology provides this opportunity to open us out to an understanding of the unknowable in a way we never could have. It also has the potential of completely twisting it to the point where we have no idea what the other person's talking about.
Right. Well, are we lost as a people without myth? Like if we don't really have connections to our ancestors, our tribe? I mean, I think about especially here, us in the United States, you know, it seems like we're maybe more disconnected than other people. Does that affect us? Does that make us more susceptible to dogma?
For a lot of people, that's a terrifying feeling, and so they run to a dogma for grounding. Joe liked to talk about the fact that, as he put it, we live in a terminal moraine. A moraine is the field of that exists after a glacier moves through. So where a glacier moves through, it just grinds everything into into rock and bit. And it's a terminal moraine of mythic symbols and images that once upon a time were the foundations of great civilizations. So they're all around us on the ground, and they're all colliding up against each other. Why are they around us on the ground? Because they've also been ripped apart by this glacier of cultural change that's moved around the world. Things have become unmoored. Another essay he wrote called, you know, talked about the symbol that was unmoored. So what it requires of us is to go in there and to construct for ourselves something that works and find other people for who are willing to live into the same story. It's not handed to us. It may require revisioning and retelling, as all good stories do. Sprung from nowhere. It's sprung from this narrative that the human animal has been engaged in for millennia.
Well, you know, when I was teaching Cakes for the Queen of Heaven, one of the classes is about giving ourselves permission to change the myths, because
yes.
Myths shape society, and all of the myths our patriarchal culture have grown up on is the father, the male leader, the male authority. Mm-hmm. And if we would go back to some of the goddess myths, where, you know, there was the goddess, Demeter, Persephone, or something like that,
mm-hmm.
Where we have women leaders, female deities, that's what you're talking about, really, in terms of reshaping, rethinking, reclaiming a different myth for yourself, which then can take root in your tribe, in your community, maybe even in society eventually.
Yes, and you speak in terms continuously of the sacred feminine, and in all kinds of traditions. Many of my neo-pagan friends, for example, are clearly in a covenant of the goddesses. The female imagery that they've recovered, or they've attempted to recover, because it's been, you know, successfully subsumed, and yet, you know, there are still places where, you know, the Balkans being a great example, and so important to Maria's work, where the tradition has still carried on in different ways. But I think there's also the trap in terms of saying, okay, if we just recover this, everything's going to be fine, because we then have to meld that in some manner with the world we live in now and the changing dynamic of the feminine.
Mm-hmm.
In all of its forms, and it's very easy to, you know, idealize, you know, Mother Nature, you know, and then a tsunami comes along.
Mm-hmm.
But then you say, what do you do with this? Well, you know, then, you know, if you're really sort of dancing around in mythology, you know, you might start to look at Kali and some
mm-hmm.
of the images in some other traditions, which take, you know, the feminine and show that it's sacred both in its generative and its destructive side,
right.
You know?
Right.
And there's every evidence that many of the early female-dominated cultures had many of the same problems that the male had. You know? And so it was less the gender than the, if you will, the politics of power.
Right.
And so that's another dynamic that's easily glossed. And yet, if you're really going to grapple with the sacred feminine, if you're going to grapple with the, you know, the energies that are animating our male-dominated world today, you've got to realize that all of these things are two-edged swords.
Right, and I certainly understand what you're talking about. It's really the politics of power, in a lot of cases, rather than a gender issue,
because you see
the politics of power among women, and it's just as ugly as patriarchy.
Right, and we must understand that that's a shadow side of mythology. The mythologies
right.
have traditionally often been used to enforce and reinforce the power.
Right.
You know, or in its earliest manifestations, back in the time of the Golden Bough and ritual regicide and things like that, it was again, the mythologies were literalized You got to cut down the plant in order to get the seed, in order for it to grow. You got to cut down the king in order to bring on the new growth.
You know, right.
You've got to make these sacrifices to the earth. So give me your most beautiful young woman and your most beautiful young man, and let them fall in love. And at the moment they consummate their relationship, we'll let the building collapse on them, and they will die, and that will give birth to the. So that's a fairly barbaric literalization of a metaphoric understanding.
Yeah, and again, somebody's dogma.
Right,
as opposed to something prescribed by some unknowable force, deity,
yep.
or whatever you want to
yep.
call it, if you will.
Yep. Yep, that's the lesson of Isaac. We used to say in the 60s, don't let him Isaac you. You know,
and what
did
that...
Well, meaning in the story of Isaac being asked to be sacrificed, you know, Abraham being asked to sacrifice Isaac to his God.
Right.
You know, you don't want to be Isaac. You don't want to be sacrificed to your father's God.
It's quite
a different thing to sacrifice yourself to your own God.
Right.
Okay.
Well, believe it or not, we only have 28 minutes. An hour and a half has gone by.
No.
I wanted to ask you, at Gaia Fest, we were talking, I think it might have been Stephen Geringer, and you had brought up one of the reasons Goddess might have disappeared from the world stage, because there was a shift from the sort of we mentality to the I mentality, which you called the rational mind. Does that mean the we mentality, where it's sort of groupthink as opposed to individualism, is irrational?
No. It's just simply connected. I mean, if you think about, and let's take this back to a look at gender in a way that actually, you know, Campbell did, but it got him in trouble with, especially with early feminists. He would say that he would cite all kinds of examples and traditions where the young woman at the time that she comes into menses in a primitive, she would be put into a hut, and she would sit there for one menstrual cycle, and she was. She became a woman. It was a biological thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened to the men? Well, they had to go out and slay some dragon, they had to do something that said, here's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
I am now a man. Okay?
Okay.
The women didn't have, they knew they were a woman. They didn't have to do anything for that. Okay?
Okay.
And he would say that's the difference between the we connectedness of woman who realizes that she is, you know, this essential element of the life cycle of the species, and the man's out there trying to say, hey, I'm here too, you know. Here's who I am.
I'm important.
I'm important. And so you even get all the patriarchy, you get all these rules, because, you know, how do I know that this is, you know, how do I know that this child is in fact my child? You know, and you got all these mythic stories of all that kind of stuff where, you know, it's not really this, and this one comes along, and the cousin comes along and impregnates the, you know, it's just, and so the I becomes more and more restrictive.
So you weren't talking about necessarily. I mean, like, there's some English scholars who put out this book that, early man, I think it might have been Neanderthal. They were a compassionate society, so we get the idea things were maybe more egalitarian. Everybody sort of looked out for each other. Women and children at the center, rather on the fringes. Everything was for the community. It was more of a we mentality. We're in this together, rather than survival of the fittest. Are we talking
now,
about the
yeah,
same thing
yeah,
or something
see,
different?
I mean, I think that's a myth in terms of life.
Okay.
Joe liked to, you know, he said that, you know, mythology arises out of two fundamental, you know, human experiences. One is the recognition of death, and the other is the awakening of awe. We talked a little bit before about the awakening of awe, looking at that night sky and having it be mystery and magic to you as opposed to fear. You can have that moment when the sun comes over the horizon and you're transported. But we're talking now about the recognition of death and the common human experiences that life lives on life. And almost every mythology exists in part to reconcile the human compassion, the human instinct to protect and look out for each other with the idea that something's got to die for me to live. In the we society we're talking about, you know, an example would be the Bushmen who, or most early hunters who go out in order to hunt. They first meditate, they find centered, they go out, they speak to the animal, they communicate with the spirit of the animal and saying, you know, I need, you know, my people need for you to die for us to live. And the reports are continuous in terms of, you know, the animal stands there while the hunter slays it. And then when the hunter comes back, there's this period in which the people embrace and surround and support this person while he, because it was typically a male function, he, you know, comes to grips with the fact that he has just slain another entity. That's, you know, that's one half, and the other, and yet on the other hand, you know, Schopenhauer later would talk about why is it that a policeman or a fireman or someone, or even just a normal person, you say walking across a bridge and someone goes to jump, they'll reach out to grab that person, even though the force of that person might carry them, force of that person's fall could well carry them right over the side to their own death. And Schopenhauer says that's because in that moment you see a metaphysical principle breaking through into actuality. The metaphysical principle is I and the other are one. Okay? And that is being manifested. So you've got that going on in the human experience, and on the other side of the human experience you've got this idea that something must die for this I to go on. So I would say to you that underneath all these early mythologies, be they matriarchal or patriarchal in nature, there is this understanding that there is this, you know, innate cruelty necessary for survival. Now, that can get way out of hand. And, you know, in our world today, it is way out of hand. You know, all of the slaughter is not necessary to survival of life. But on the other hand, we've gotten way far away from that. We don't think about the chicken that's got to be killed in order for us to eat. You know, we go to the grocery store and it's wrapped in plastic. Or Joe used to say to people who would, you know, get on him about that rare roast beef quip I mentioned to you, he'd say, what do you mean? Don't tell me you're vegetarian. Do you think lettuce had to be uprooted and die in order for you to, you know, you don't think it? This is because the carrot can't run away. It's not alive. You know, but when you stop and think about it, we've lost track of that.
Right.
You know, and what do we see in our culture around us? All of this vicarious violence. All of that violent, we project it out in slasher movies and all this other stuff. And what's the other side of that? We spend heavily on police and armies to control these urges because, hey, it's not me. It's the other guy who's violent.
So
I'm
you're
a
saying,
pacifist.
So are you saying you think earlier in the beginning we still had that interconnection, that awareness that we've lost today?
Yes, absolutely. And it existed. You know, hey, most of us don't even live in proximity to our immediate family.
Right.
Forget about living in proximity to, you know, generation upon generation of a people. And when you still try to do that nowadays, you're seeing the tribalism coming up. But then again, you know, Joe talked about this. He's saying, you know, whenever you remove a sort of dominant mythology that's given form. Think about the Reformation, where you remove the Christian power, the Catholic, you know, interrelated relationship with the political structure. Well, suddenly you have all these feudalism. You remove communism,
It's like a vacuum. You create a vacuum. Is that what you mean?
Yes, and he said, imagine you have a box and you have cold air on one side and hot air on the other, and it's separated by a barrier in a vacuum. You pull away that barrier, they rush together, and you have a violent storm. Now, of course, we know that the end of that is it all turns into precipitation. It falls all back down, be it snow, be it rain, be it hail, but it's still water, okay? But to get to that commonality of water, there is in this inevitable clash when you remove the constraining aspect. And the constraining aspect is frequently the dominant mythology.
Well, you're making me think about Egypt. You know, they remove Mubarak, and now they have chaos, and you don't know what's going to fill the vacuum.
Exactly. And of course, immediately in that situation, you start to get fear, and you start to say, oh, my God, let it be anybody but the Muslim Brotherhood. You immediately go into this tribalism.
Right. Well, we have like about 20 minutes left now, 19 minutes. You talked earlier about our recognizing our own personal myth. How does one figure out what their personal myth is? I mean, is that difficult? I mean, or is it obvious?
I think first of all, it's a process that's ongoing because it doesn't remain static. I mean, it's not like, I think mythology is a dynamic thing, and as you grow older and as you may move to different places and come up against different people, you're constantly revising your understanding. If you're not change adverse, and if you're a person who's vitally growing, you're constantly reevaluating. So I don't think it's a fixed thing, but I do workshops about exactly that. But one clue that I found very potent is comes out of Carl Jung, and Jung writes about how when he was in his later years, he had been talking about mythology and talking about people's spiritual dynamic. And he suddenly said, I asked myself, if it's so important to have a mythology, what's my mythology? You know, what myth am I living by? And then he said I had to honestly say that I didn't know. And so he said he made it his task of tasks to figure that out. Now in Jung's case, he asked himself this question. He said, what did I do as a child that made time stand still? And he remembered that he used to like to push rocks around and play with stone. And so he stopped what he's doing. He built Bollingen, the stone tower, that became his study and the place that he worked out of. But there's a clue in there. What is it that you do, or what is it in your life, okay, that makes time stand still? When, think back to when you were a child, because most of us don't have, unless we're engaged in a creative passion. The dancer says at a certain point, I'm not the dancer, I become the dance. Or the musician says, the music plays me. And in the East, they say, the musician says, believe that the music always exists, and that their job as a musician is you dip down into the stream of music and you ride it, and then you come back out. An athlete talks about being in the zone. And all of those things come from some kind of personal dynamic, if it hasn't been squashed out of you in elementary school, some creative expressive force that takes you out of yourself. There are ways that you can create a sacred space, a space in which you do that. There's a lot of different people will offer you all kinds of different techniques, and it isn't one size fits all. I always say, okay, think back, when you were a kid, was there anything that happened when suddenly you get called for dinner and you don't know where the day went? Start there.
So what really fulfills you? What gives you joy? What's your bliss, kind of a thing?
Well, it is sort of what's your bliss, but it's what takes you out of the quotidian day to day of time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what makes time stand still? When suddenly I'm having an enjoyable conversation with you, but more than that, I mean, we're into a space where what happened, Karen, to the last hour and 45 minutes? Okay,
it just flew by.
Exactly. Exactly. And we've also all had the experience of sitting there and watching that clock and thinking, oh, my God, it's never going to get to 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So I say find a time in your own day-to-day life where you let yourself step outside of time, however you want to do it. If it means, you know, go walk in the woods and, you know, go to the top of the mountain or, go dribble a basketball or, do aerobics or meditate or paint that picture or listen to that piece of music or go into your kitchen and, you're suddenly not thinking about cooking dinner, but you're cooking. I mean, you're putting things together. You're the alchemist. We all have things that take us to that place. And it's different strokes for different folks, truly.
And it will sometimes change. And by finding that, then how do you name it, for instance? Is it going to be an archetype? Is it going to, be something like an archetype?
I don't think you do name it. I mean, I think as soon as you name it, you're back trying to tell Joe what it is.
Okay.
It is you. It is your time for you. You don't try to put a name on it. You just want to explore where it takes you.
It's more of a feeling.
Exactly. When people say follow your bliss, I say bliss isn't a thing, it's a process.
Okay. Okay. All right. That makes sense. Now this may be something that we don't have enough time for. So I'll go on to something a little simpler. When I was reading some of your work, I saw you talk about people's passions, urges, furies that become equated with spiritual revelations, and then that in turn becomes the basis for our gods, our human urges, our psychosis. And you said those urges denied become our devils, and the urges honored become our gods. Is that too big of a subject for 5 or 6 minutes?
Well, I don't know. We've been pretty much ranging over. The thing is that it comes back to this idea of what makes time stand still. It comes back to this idea of what are the things that you honor. Well, if you honor the deepest parts of yourself, they are your gods. They are the things you hold sacred. And you probably don't name them because you don't want to cast your pearls before swine. But you probably don't. It's like how a novelist is reluctant to talk about the novel that they're working on because if they talk about it, they can't work on it anymore. The painter paints, but at a certain point, the painter walks away. So, on the other hand, if you repress it, if you put it down, yeah, it's going to come back and bite you again and again and again. And psychology shows us, all kinds of examples of that to the point where you repress it enough, it becomes psychosis. In other words, if you repress it and you don't, that means in no way you don't give it any voice, you don't share it with anyone, you don't connect it in any way. Well, I mean, if you have, some people come and say, I've got a really strong personal, mythology, and then they go on to some, symbolic rant that has Klingons and UFOs and all this other stuff in it, and it may make great sense for them, but as an objective observer, someone they think they're trying to talk to, I don't call it a personal mythology, I call it psychosis. So,
or could you say someone who, I don't know, maybe grows up thinking sex is evil or dirty, and they never engage in the natural function, and then it becomes a psychosis, or maybe they become a serial killer or something.
Watch Criminal Minds.
I do.
Yeah, there you are. But, I mean, that's it. Exactly. That's the whole premise of this. And they even, throw in quotes from Nietzsche at the top to try to tell you.
Oh, I love their quotes. I write down their quotes often.
Well, there you are. But I think there's a real truth in there. They're saying this is not just a metaphysical principle. This is something that actually shapes human behavior.
Absolutely.
And look at what happens when it shapes it in this twisted way.
Right.
We all say that, Hitler did what he did because he was really a failed musician. His mother didn't. I mean, there's you can reduce it to a lot of absurdity, but there is an awful lot of psychological literature that shows us that that's what happens.
Wow.
Try to put Pandora, all the stuff back in Pandora's box. You can't do it.
Well, you know, I read something that said the reason why Sarah Palin is out there doing what she's doing, aside from, you know, she's becoming a millionaire, is because she was so felt so rejected by the loss and by the put-downs she was receiving, you know, that made her look, not curious, should we say, you know, to be kind. And this is her payback.
There you are.
I don't know. Just
yeah, who knows? Yeah, but that would be the same idea expressed.
Same kind of thing.
And the other thing we watch, you know, we've been watching. Why do we have this fascination with the Charlie Sheens and the Linda Lohans and all these other people? You know, we watch this going on. This is not a whole lot different than the Greeks talking, you know, sitting around and talking about. The soap opera that was happening on Mount Olympus, as they saw it, you know, they're putting it in a different form. They're giving it different names, but we're doing the same thing. We're projecting out all this stuff on ourselves and from ourselves onto these people, and you know, but what's that also doing? That's also keep you know, hey, let me think a lot about Charlie Sheen's, you know, madness and his addiction. I don't want to talk about, you know, my own.
Right. That's a good point. That's a really good point. Now when that comes up, I'm going to think about it totally different. I think this will probably have to be the final question, and I hope we still have time for it. We hear about the hero's journey. I'm sure that could also be called the heroine's journey. What is it exactly, and how is it relevant to us in our life?
Okay. In its essence, the hero's journey says that someone is born into a village or born into a situation, and at some point they hear a call that calls them out of that, calls them out of the village and sends them into the forest, sends them into the unknown, where they are going to encounter trials and they're going to have invisible helpers and invisible adversaries, and they're all in quest of something. Typically, what the hero is in quest of is something that was missing back in the village. You know, that's logical. If it was there in the village, you wouldn't go out looking for it. And then they find this. The Grail is you know, the classic example of the symbol of this. And then they have to get back to day-to-day life. So they have to. So it's separation from the village, initiation into this other kind of world, and then return. Now. That's the basis of all the great historic stories that have come down to us. It's the basic of the story of almost all the great religious leaders, Jesus, Buddha, Luke Skywalker. It's all of this is the classic pattern, and it's also the classic pattern of anyone who steps outside of their predefined role in society. So you know, and each of these heroes, as it says in the Arthurian legends, enters the forest at the place where it was darkest and there was no path, because to enter on a path would not be following your own path, it would be following somebody else's. So we also understand this on a visceral level as something that happens to us every day. You know, we're in our day-to-day life. We are overcome by fatigue. We pass into a different realm we don't hardly understand, where familiar things become unfamiliar, and unfamiliar things are as if we've known them forever, and something happens, and we have this tremendous insight, and then we wake up. Another example, I'm a product of the 60s. Joe was very straight-laced, but in some of his talks at Esalen, you know, people would say, oh, you know, I mean, your hero with a thousand faces, you know, it was just such a guide to the trip I was on. And he said, the trip? You know, and he'd hear about people with LSD, and he said, I don't know what happened, but I figure something must have happened, because suddenly the sales of the hero went up by, you know, there was a zero on the sales total. So, you know, an extra zero. So if he'd sold, you know, 600 copies, he now sold 6,000 copies. but because it became a guidebook, it also carried over even after Campbell's posthumous celebrity, there was a book called The Writer's Journey, and it was done by a man who was an early screenplay reader at Universal, and he had a bunch of people reading screenplays for him, and he started looking at all the classic films. We could have a whole program on how films are you know, the mythological carriers of today. But so he's looking at these films, and he put out a manifesto in which told his readers, look, go about a third of the way into the script. If you haven't, read 10 pages either side, if there isn't some kind of a call to adventure, something that pulls the person out of their life and thrusts them into the bulk of the rest of the movie, don't bother reading anymore. And if there is, then go about two-thirds of the way in, and if you don't see the person trying to grapple with bringing back this insight that he's had back to, you know, his real life, don't read anymore. Because it is a dynamic of all the narratives that have endured.
I see.
You know, on its simplest level, you can say it's a beginning, a middle, and an end, but it's more than that because it presumes that you begin someplace where you share with other people. The village, the place you were born to be, and then something happens, and you can ignore it. I mean, you can hang up the phone, but it's going to happen over and over and over and over and over
again.
So
it's like a calling,
it is a calling to a quest.
Yeah,
and you know, and a famous little phrase is that, you know, the gods lead them that will, them that won't they drag. So, you know, they'll send out the little call and they'll lead you if you go, and if you won't, you know, they're going to come back and they're going to come at you again and again and again until you suddenly say, wait a minute, I got to do this.
Well, what if you're no longer part of that tribe? What if there's nobody to bring it back to? Do you create your new tribe?
That's a biggie. Yeah, that's a huge question and a very insightful one, Karen, and it's the thing that most people forget. I think you have to define yourself as being part of a tribe to begin. I mean, I think that on its most basic level, that's where Joe says all the mythologies of the future have to be about the one tribe being the tribe of humanity on this planet. And if you start out any other place, you're going to have an adventure, and maybe a hero's journey, but how can we say maybe a small J journey? Big HJ journey, then it's got to recognize that you begin someplace and somehow you've got to take this extraordinary experience of your quest, of your journey, and reintegrate it into that world, and without that world destroying you or hanging you up on a cross or treating you like the crazy person.
Right. Well, that's really interesting. That's going to be some food for thought because I'm thinking to myself, this journey I've been on, I can't see taking it back to where I started because they
you're not taking it back to where you started, but every time you have one of these conversations, you're taking it back, your insights back to your community. It's just that your community is different.
And also, the journey changes you. So, you know, I would imagine, you know, that you can't go back. You know,
right.
It's kind of like there's that element in there, too.
Yep. You think of it as a spiral where you go around and you come back to the same place, but you're not in the same place.
Gotcha. Well, Bob, we literally have 1 minute on the switchboard, and I cannot say how much I've enjoyed this. This has been awesome. I could have talked to you for another 2 hours, and I'm sure it would have flown as much as the last two. So I just want to say thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you, Karen. And do remind your listeners to go to jcf.org if they want to sort of continue the conversation with their peers.
Yes, so that's JCF, Joseph Campbell Foundation.org. Well, thank you so much, Bob, and I look forward to seeing you somewhere down the road again. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Send me a flyer the next time you talk, and I'll see you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, and good night.
Good night.
Well, listeners, we only have a few moments left here. I'm sure you enjoyed that as much as I did. And our guest next week, I think you'll enjoy as well. I'm reserving the whole show for her, Marguerite Rigoglioso. She's the author of When God Was a Virgin Mother, The Eleusinian Mysteries Illuminated. Very interesting stuff, including information about an older Athena, the one that wasn't birthed from Zeus' head. And our talk, we're also going to discuss a new new interpretation for Persephone's rape by Hades, and much more. She's a return guest to the show, and our listeners always find her work very interesting. So please tune in next Wednesday, and same time, same place, and thank you very much for being a listener to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. Until next Wednesday, good night, and have a good week.